Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by Josh Deshay. He's the Director of Channel Partnerships over at First Star HR. Love that that rhymes, by the way. And awesome. Today, we're taking a little bit of a different direction because Josh is actually allergic to metrics. He wears a little bracelet. So if he ever does come in contact with them, he's got an EpiPen and you can stab him in the thigh. But that's the goal or the direction we're taking the conversation here is the rise of the anti-metric sales leader. And so Josh, welcome to the show.
Man, it's great to be here. I am excited. I'm excited to spread my message of the bane of my existence, which is metrics-based sales.
Cool. I love it because, you know, I think it's so easy to get tied into metrics are the only thing that matters, right? Yeah. And we had Bilal on the podcast, a couple weeks ago, depending on when this was recorded and when it gets pushed out. And he talked about some of the worst behaviors and the worst practices. Mm-hmm. And I think being overly metrics driven or solely metrics driven can steer the wrong behaviors. So I'm excited to sort of have you on the show because we're taking this in a totally different direction from most. Whereas most newly installed sales managers or sales development leaders, it's all about the dashboard. You manage from the dashboard. Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing that I've learned, not in sales specifically, just sort of running a company, is that it's never just about the data. The data tells one thing, and then there's the sort of qualitative story that goes along with it, and it has to be the balance of the two. Right. And so let's go in the total opposite direction of a balanced approach, and let's say fuck metrics. We're not gonna look at those anymore. Talk to me about the problem. Why are metrics the root of all evil?
So it's interesting. We all know one thing that we're taught in sales from a very early age, right, as in our sales careers, is that trust is one of the number one reasons people buy. Yet, we're told that we need to turn into robots and cold call or reach out to 50, 100, 200, 1,000 people trying to get them to say yes to a meeting. And it's all based upon the volume of people that you can get a hold of. Mm-hmm. So how are those two things, how do they work together? They don't, right? So what you're doing is you're telling salespeople that trust is number one and it's super important. And I believe that. I think anyone who's ever bought something of value understood the fact that the trust had to be there before they were willing to break out their checkbook. So one, we're teaching salespeople two diametrically different things and expecting them to do both, right? And is it any wonder because of that we have fewer and fewer people wanting to be in sales from an early age? You know, and no one, I'm sorry, I don't like to use blanket statements. No one can fight me on that. We have less people right now wanting to be in sales than ever before. More people are in sales today because they failed in another career. And that never happened in the past. In the past, sales, being in sales, it was a noble profession. I think Leave It to Beaver, I think wasn't their dad was like an insurance salesperson. And he was like the model dad, husband, business person. So we've come from that to now an industry where people can make tons of money, yet it's the third, fourth, fifth, sixth choice in someone's career. So I believe that metrics has done that.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the perception, at least when I was growing up, is largely driven by, like, if you think about what are the major purchases, right, in somebody's life. So first it's a car, then it's a house. Mm-hmm. Right. Maybe it's the other way around. I live in Vancouver. It's like, it's a car and then live with your parents.
Right.
Because it's the real estate's crazy here. But if you look at, okay, well, you're buying your first car, you're buying a brand new car. Probably not. You're buying a used car. And so I think a lot of people's impressions are maybe shaped by used car salespeople. right? And so they think, ah, that shyster salesperson was trying to screw me over. It's yada, yada, yada. I don't like sales. I don't like people in sales. And if you look at, if we sort of diagnose, the bad behaviors that are, coming from that individual salesperson. And I know I'm grouping a whole lot of salespeople in with this blanket statement, including myself. I can't say I'm a used cars salesman, but I can say I have sold, I'm a used car salesman. I sold one car. I did it for a couple of weeks. I thought it'd be an interesting job, but really I wanted to piss my mom off because her dad owned a car dealership. And she said, one thing that you can't do is sell cars. And I was like, okay, that sounds like a fun thing to do for a couple of weeks. So these bad behaviors are given the industry sort of a bad name. Where do you think they sort of originate from?
So it's funny you're talking about car salesmen. I know quite a few car salesmen. I know some great people that sell cars.
So do
I. Let's look at that industry though, real quick, in terms of why that industry gets a bad rap. So on a car lot, whether it's new or used, by the way, either way, you have salespeople for the most part. Now it's changing with the internet. People are starting to send in internet requests. The consumer has more power. But for the longest time, what happened? You walked up to a car dealership and the next person in line came out to sell you. So that salesperson didn't have to do any work to get you in the door, right? They just came. It was like the miraculous, what all of us want in sales, just leads flowing to us. So there was no buy-in from the salesperson saying, I've worked hard getting this person in here. I need to treat them this way because I need to make, it might be the only sale I get today. Basically at that point, it was volume. And that's what metrics teaches. It was a volume, understanding that, look, this person doesn't work, on to the next. Mm-hmm. That mentality creates in the salesperson a lack of emphasis on making sure I take care of this person now because it might be the only one I talk to. Back in the day in sales, if you've been in any other kind of sales, insurance, real estate, mortgage, IT, every single client that comes through the door, you're more than likely the one that brought them in. So you care a little bit more. You treat them a little bit better. You go through, you develop trust and those sort of things. So the big difference there, right, is a volume-based, right, versus a value-based. And the metrics way of doing sales takes it away from the value and puts it on volume, which means, oh, you don't want to buy from me? Screw you. Hang up. Call the next person. Over and over and over again. So to me, that's why that industry and other industries like it have gotten a bad rap. And it is not just a bad rap. It is the appropriate rap for most of those individuals.
Mm-hmm. And I think one factor that's got to play into it, that forces that, the sort of like dehumanization of the sales process, is the lack of companies investing in their salespeople. And by that, I mean paying them a reasonable base salary and decent commissions, as opposed to, I want to pay my salespeople the smallest base possible and then only pay them a reasonable salary if they're actually doing their job and closing, right? I think that it puts the salesperson and the consumer at odds, because in that case, the salesperson is just trying to win and the consumer is just like, it's a combative situation. And rightly so, the person buying a car wants to spend the least amount of money on that to get the best deal. The salesperson needs to make a certain amount of money to live because they're not getting paid a healthy base by their company.
Yeah, absolutely. I had this discussion with a CFO, that's been a couple of years now, and he was in Vistage, if you know that organization. If anybody's watching this and loves their Vistage group, close your ears. He told me, I'm trying to figure out how to pay our salespeople. My Vistage group says, just like what you just said there, my Vistage group says that we should pay them less on salary and just load up their commission scale. And I looked at him and said, you're the reason, if you do this, you're going to be the reason that sales consistently don't work. You're going to be the reason that you have a high attrition rate with your salespeople. And it's going to be the reason that people in your organization feel less valued. And then I asked him this question. I said, as the CFO, would you ever take a compensation plan that way? Okay, so here's what I'm going to do, Mr. CFO. I'm going to pay you, and you're probably worth right now in the open market $300 an hour. I'm going to pay you $50 an hour overall. But when you hit your metrics as a CFO, I'm going to give you unlimited compensation. And he said, well, absolutely not, I wouldn't. I said, you wouldn't, because it would that's a slap in the face. And every time you tell a salesperson that, hey, you're going to make a ton of money, but I only value enough to pay you $2,000 a month, well, you're just making that guy go look for the next best thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. I agree with you completely.
Couldn't agree more. And there are some people that can be super successful on those low base, super high commissions, and like, power to you. I agree with you. It's not a respectful way to treat salespeople.
And it's not even about whether or not they can be successful that way. It's about, as a leader, you're supposed to think about, what's the mindset of my employee right now? Now, what they're going to tell you is they don't want someone to get comfortable. Well, you, in the back of your mind, you're tracking what they're selling anyway. So you say you don't want to pay them $100,000 a year. You're not going to pay them $100,000 a year if after 3 months they're not selling anything. So don't tell me you don't want to pay $100,000 a year to a really good salesperson in a salary, because you're not gonna if they're not producing. And so, again, it's more about the mindset of the employee, and it's knowing that when someone feels valued, they work harder for you. And that's something that I think we've gotten away from when it comes to leadership and executives in terms of hiring salespeople and determining what their compensation plan is.
I totally agree. And it's because it comes down to hiring, and you might have had bad experiences with salespeople, but you've hired the wrong people for the wrong roles, or for the, you're hiring for the right role, but you hire the wrong people. The salespeople I know, sort of myself included, it's not about the money. It's about the competition, right? The only way you're going to get complacency in your sales team is if you hire people that are complacent by nature. Right. So that's a hiring problem. It's not a compensation problem. It's, you got to bring the right people into that role.
Well, and it's a being valued problem. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. So the reason that I picked First Star HR, and I had another position lined up and they were ready, I had interviews over the phone with the other company. I'd met them in person. First Star HR came in and I interviewed with the CEO and the CFO, and they took me to lunch. So you're talking about a good-sized company, the CEO and CFO both talking to me over lunch like I'm a normal human being. I tell them what I need. They say, we'll make it work. An hour and a half later, I had an offer, and they wanted me to start real quickly. It was about value. They valued me. They wanted me, and they made it happen. You think about the way that the normal process works for a salesperson. We're going to vet you like crazy. We're going to make you jump through all of these hoops, make you do all these stupid assessments. We're going to go call all of your references. And then after we say, yeah, we want to hire you, okay, we're going to pay you $2,000 a month, $5,000 a month, but you're going to have unlimited potential.
Yeah.
What the hell? It's enough to make anyone feel as though they're not wanted. And that's exactly why the retention for salespeople is so low.
And it's not honest. It's not genuine. Right. It's not honest. And we just interviewed last year, and we went through a couple rounds of like, we hired somebody, let them go, hired somebody, let them go, found somebody great. But when we were hiring for senior sales leader position, the number of applicants I talked to, and they're like, I'm talking like, oh, so what's your OTE? I'm like, oh, it's like 350, 270, 400. I'm like, okay, well, what are you actually going to achieve? Because there aren't too many people here in Vancouver that are, that are making those numbers, unless you're working for like one or two companies. So what are you actually going to do? And the guy who had said he had a 270 OTE, he's like, oh, probably like 170, 180. I'm like, okay, so you can't use that OTE number to sell somebody on a roll, because that's bullshit. It's like, what would need to happen for you to hit that, to hit that OTE? And he's like, magic. Every single one of my reps would have to be 110% of productivity. And it's like, okay, what are the chances of that happening? And it's like, well, you got the standard bell curve. And so it's just, it's impossible. It's not genuine. And it's a demotivator, and it's going to, you're going to have your best people leave.
Yep.
We just finished we looked at our sales plan for our reps, and we looked at what's the OTE that we committed to paying them. And what is that sort of split that we want it to be, and said, hey, you know, do we have enough pipeline to support that? And do we have enough pipeline so that when we like, so that I feel confident that I told the truth when we hired these guys and said, you're going to make X, they have the opportunity to make X. And that's a reality that doesn't have to be like they, one could hit it and one couldn't hit it. It's like, no, if I'm going to promise somebody an OTE, you're going to be able to hit that OTE, or else you're probably going to get fired. And there's going to be opportunity for upside, and there's, you know, multipliers, et cetera. But I think one of the most important things you can do when you're hiring salespeople is making sure that it's, they've got a genuine number that they feel like they can hit, and they know how to do it.
Exactly. And again, I just always go back to when it comes to this discussion. So now that I do business consulting, I'm talking with the chief sales officers all the time. And most of that is about, okay, we're going to go in and we're going to completely revamp what it is you're doing for salespeople. And that discussion always leads to this discussion. How do we pay? And the question is always, we don't get it. Well, the answer is we don't get enough good people, right? We don't get the good salespeople. And when we do, they leave. Well, duh. Again, yeah. It's what you just said. And by the way, when you have like a salesperson coming in touting an OTE that isn't necessarily achievable, part of that's because they've been taught by really crappy organizations that they're going to have to overstate what it is they probably need to do in order to get a level where they can actually live, right? Which is tough. And then it's this big circle where it makes it really difficult on the salesperson. Then the salesperson comes in and realizes everything is shit. And it's, again, you would never treat a director of human resources like this. You would never treat one of the head marketing people this way. You would never treat, the underwriters this way. And look, as salespeople, we get a bad rap a lot of times, and it's legit. Salespeople can be assholes. We can walk around like we own the place. That's leadership. So leaders, if you don't like how salespeople act, then fix it. And fix it by letting them know they don't have to walk around like that, because we're going to value you from the start. And so anyway, I think that the metrics-based system really has caused that, by the way. Because what happens, right? Why is it that a director of human resources is told he can only pay $2,000 a month, yet you're going to have unlimited potential? He's told that because they look at metrics and go, if he makes 50 phone calls a day, he's gonna talk to 20 people, and he's gonna set 10 appointments, and we have an 18.9% closing ratio.
Yeah.
And so you're gonna sell 1 to 2 people. If you do that every single day, at the end of the month, you're gonna. So they look at it from a metric standpoint to determine what it is that salesperson can do, and now what you have is an unattainable amount that's, no one ever hits the OTE that the organization thinks they're going to hit. No one. The vast majority don't.
Yeah. And the question, if you're interviewing somewhere, is what percentage of your reps are on quota versus behind?
That's right.
And the common answer I hear is like, oh, it's 1 or 2 guys. You know, at the best I've heard is like 50, 60%.
Yep. And that's, and by the way, if you hear that, the next thing out of your mouth should be, it was great talking to you, because you're not going to change that as the sales guy coming in. Mm-hmm. If that organization is, they're at a 20% when it comes to where they are with their plan consistently. And then you go look at it. One of those guys is blowing it out of the water, right? And the other 20 aren't, you need to get out. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. And that's not about the product. It's about leadership.
Totally. Yeah. Do you want one guy that brings in all of your revenue, or do you want everybody consistently sharing?
That's what the metrics model does. That's what metrics does, is it creates a very, very wealthy side, right? And then you have no middle class, and you have the lower class. You know, you have a bunch of D players and you have one A player, and the organization's going to fall as soon as the A player gets an executive role at the next company.
And sometimes it's not even a true A player. It's just lucky sperm. I've seen that's it right. in a number of organizations, you know, here in Vancouver, where I know people that are AEs, SDRs, sales leaders. And if you're like, you've got great people that are in the sort of shitty side of the business, you know, mm-hmm. you're selling something to an industry that isn't crazy, that's not crazy relevant, you're going to work your ass off and you're going to get paid like crap. Then if you happen to be lucky enough to be on the great accounts or the great territory, you're just going to crush it. And you're not necessarily a better sales rep. You just have a better territory.
That's right. Well, and again, also part of it, right, is there was a time, and we talked about this at the beginning, sales was viewed different 50, 60 years ago. Again, my family grew up in the insurance business. I had a grandfather that was in insurance, and back in the day, you could go knock on doors. You could go knock on someone's door and sell that MF or behind the door life insurance. Matter of fact, it wasn't even selling it. They would invite you in. You would have a Coca-Cola with them at the dinner table and just by happenstance walk out with a life insurance application.
Yeah.
And if you tried that now, one, if you tried to get someone to do it, the person would laugh at you and say, screw you, where are my leads? And then two, you go knock on, go to any neighborhood in the United States right now or overseas and go knock on a door. The first thing they're wondering is, who the hell are you? Are you selling? What are you selling? And most of them have either a no soliciting sign on the door or those things that says, we already have this, we already have this, we already have this, we already have this, we already have this. Thank you so much.
So funny sidebar, because you mentioned selling, knocking on doors in Europe.
Yeah.
One of the SDRs that we hired had door knocking experience in Germany. And I was like, cool, what'd you sell? Baked goods. I was like, no fucking way.
That is crazy.
It's amazing. It was basically like, it wasn't like a hipster delivery service or whatnot. It was like a giant bakery, and they would send the truck by once a week and bring you bread and muffins, et cetera. And he door knocked for that. I might have the product slightly wrong, but it was like baked goods. I could not believe it.
And how was he doing?
I think so obviously he's not working there anymore. I think he got some good experience. He made some good money on a couple of months, but eventually churned out. Right. And a model like that, I think this is proof that this guy's going to crush it in sales. And the model brought him in, taught him how to sell, and then spat him out after giving him all this great experience. And it was like, okay, you're not valuable to us anymore. And that to me is insanity.
Yep. I agree. So
how do we make this shift from insanity to humanizing how we run our sales teams?
Yeah. So we already talked about one of them, right? Which is pay salespeople as though you value their contribution. Again, when we pay them based upon all commissions, what we're telling them is, you're just a dime a dozen. I can find anyone to fill this job. And we all know that's total bullshit. Mm-hmm. How, outside of finding a great service person, which is really difficult, finding a competent salesperson is virtually impossible these days, right? So one, it's pay. Two, you've got to shift your mindset from volume to value. Right? Volume to value. Volume being just talk to as many people as you can. That's all you need. To value, who do you need to talk to? What research are you doing on these individuals? If you really do have a 20% closing ratio, then talk to 10 amazing people a day. Find out who they are. And then go create great relationships with these people. You're still going to sell 20% off the 10 appointments that you were going to have anyway, and you have a much happier salesperson. Again, look at two models, and I actually went through this with a current partner that I'm trying to get to sell for us. The other model, and I think I said per day earlier, which was wrong. The other model that I had always had in the insurance business was 50 great calls a month will create 20 actual conversations. 20 conversations will create 10 appointments. And from those 10 appointments, 18%, so 1 to 2 sales. Okay, you could do that monthly. Rack your brain over cold calls and people that you don't know. Or you could research the hell out of 10 people that fit the niche that you need You get to know the community they're in. You go out and get to know those people. You form relationships with those people because you know, by the way, because you've done research, that they need what you have. And your 18 to 20% still applies. You sold one to two deals anyway. Chances are you sell more because you actually got to know those people and they fit your network. You have a happy salesperson who then will say, why don't I go do 20 of these a month? And now you have a self-fulfilling prophecy of goodness instead of, oh, hell, here comes the salesperson who talks to everyone in the community without getting to know who they are. So the way that you fix this is you take away the emphasis on volume. Stop asking, how many phone calls did you make today? Instead, ask, who did you get to know in the community today? What did you do in the community today? What events are you taking part in the community today? What did you give back this week to the community? And when you start doing that, now you're value, right, over volume. And if you're willing to do that with your salespeople, at the end of the month, if it's a 20% close ratio, you don't give a shit how many people they talk to as long as they get that one or two. It doesn't make any sense not to do it that way. So that's how you fix this. Second thing, real quick, you've got to have really strong middle management in order to pull this off, right? Because think about it, the metrics-based stuff comes from CFOs, people that do numbers for a living. And what they're doing is they're saying, well, each deal is worth this, therefore we need to sell this many. What do the stats say about how many people we have to talk to get those sales? Right, that's what they're doing. And then they push it to the middle manager who needs that job. He probably was promoted because he sold a lot and has no clue about leadership. And he goes, sure, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And he goes out and pushes it. You need strong middle management who's willing to say, I'm going to get you the sales, but I need for you to allow me to get them to do it the way I know best.
For sure.
So that's the other thing that's missing.
And you got to have senior leadership on board with, hey, we're doing this differently, and they're going to support those middle managers. Cause it's one thing for them to be able to stand up, but that's when there's so much top-down pressure coming on these middle managers, they're only going to last for so long before you're like, all right, you know what? I'm either going to just cave or I'm going to find somewhere else where my talents are appreciated.
Well, and now here's where I'll push back on those individuals. You're absolutely right. Well, you need it, but you can get that support from executives if you prove it. Because in the end, they just want to sell. And if you tell them, hey, hold on, that's the old way of doing things. It's the reason people hate salespeople. Here's what we're going to do this quarter. I'll stake my middle management job on this. And it's interesting because people tend to think, right, that they can't do that. But they can. Because most middle managers in a sales organization were just good salespeople from before. And by the way, you're taking less money to be that middle manager. So if the middle manager will put his big boy pants on and say, you know what, screw this. I can go get a job anywhere and sell and make a lot of money. I'm going to make this work. If they're willing to do that, and if they're willing to take that risk, they're going to sell. And so, it takes the executives and the upper management to do it. But I'm telling you, middle managers, if you're watching, you know you were just a really good salesperson before. So if this doesn't work out, you can go sell somewhere and make just as much money and keep mama happy at home and have all your things. But if you succeed in it, now all of a sudden you've changed the culture of an entire organization. Now you're a legend. So that's what I think.
Love it. And so what does this look like? What does this new world look like when you're looking at an organization that isn't as metrics driven or that isn't sort of metrics first? Mm-hmm. What does that look like to you? And where does that start?
Well, again, it starts middle manager. Here's what happens when you move. Think about what it is that is the mindset of most salespeople right now in an organization. They're stressed out, right? They're stressed out. They're looking at their numbers all the time. They take that stress home. They have headaches. They can't sleep. I was reading a stat, and again, don't quote me on it because I don't know where I read it, but I remember reading it 4 or 5 years ago that salespeople, especially on big ticket items, tend to have a higher divorce rate than other people, right? They're always stressed out. And so what does that do? It causes breakdowns. It causes again, your employee attrition in that organization goes through the roof. And you have a place where people don't love working. Imagine if you made a shift and instead of walking in a Monday morning meeting, you said, we're not doing a meeting today. You need to be in the community. What if instead you had a biweekly meeting where you talked about the community at large and what's happening this month in the community? What are y'all a part of? Who are you talking to and getting to know? What are you not a part of that you need to be? And then once a month, you had a one-on-one with that salesperson where you asked, okay, so who do you think your targets are for the next quarter? You know, of the, you know, you're talking maybe seeing 10 people a month and developing how many relationships are you into right now of that 30? What makes it special? What makes it work? How close do you think you are? What, all of a sudden, by the way, you're enabling that salesperson to have a say in their career. They are less stressed out. They're creating relationships in the community. And they're selling just as much because they're not stressed out. As a matter of fact, they're happier because their wife or their husband at home doesn't hate them. Their kids see them, right? Because you're talking community now. Mm-hmm. Their kids see them on a daily basis. They get a lot of sleep because they love doing what they do. They're just going out and meeting people and making a difference in people's lives. By the way, you start doing that, people start seeing your company as that. Walking into a business, B2B sales, it's nothing because they know who you are. They care. So what is it? What would it do? Oh my gosh, it looks like utopia. But the funny thing is where utopia is almost impossible to achieve, this is not.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think the one of those things, like if I think about what's causing the stress,
yeah,
it's the forecast like you talked about. It's the push. It's the crazy push at the end of the quarter, the crazy push at the end of the year. It's a few companies year end right now. And man, are we getting some great deals on software that we were going to buy anyway later this year?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was thinking about, because we use Salesforce, and I was thinking about the amount of money that they're leaving on the table because their people, the way the organization works is the best time of year to buy anything from them is right at the end of their financial year because they have the reps have the most leeway. And like, could you imagine if they were just a touch more patient, how much more, like if you were just wait 3 months for that revenue, you'd get 25, 35% more.
Well, and so the interesting thing, right, is, and it's, by the way, let's go back to the car business. What's the best time you right now in your head, if you were going to buy a car, you're trained that the end of the year is the best time to buy. Because they already have the new models out and they need to sell it. They discount the cars like crazy, all those kind of things. Yeah, I think you're right. You look at that from a different perspective. How much money is the dealership losing because they don't plan effectively throughout the year and they have to push a number through, right? Because that's how dealerships work. It's a number. It's a units. How many units and how much revenue from each? What's the average revenue per unit? Well, that's shot at the end of the year because they're scrambling around. Well, that is a direct correlation to the volume-based business that we're talking about.
Yeah.
You've got to do volume. And what they're not understanding is no matter how many people you talk to, you're going to sell this about the same amount. It's just how that works. So instead, why don't we develop better relationships, have deeper conversations, sell the same amount, make everybody happy? Matter of fact, let's do that all year so we don't have to scramble around the last 3 weeks to figure out who the hell we need to pay off in order to get someone in here. You talk to marketing firms. Marketing firms will tell you those last minute buys at the end of the year are huge and they can sell those like crazy. Oh, well, normally we're going to charge X, but it's the end of the year, so we're going to charge this much. It's businesses are shooting themselves in the foot because they're doing something that people don't like to do. They're pushing something that people don't like to be pushed on. They're creating a lack of engagement with their employees and their salespeople, and they're contributing to the bad reputation that their salespeople have. In general, it's totally inefficient, and it's a giant rat race to achieve mediocrity in sales. And until people stop doing that, we're going to have bad reps.
Yep. Yeah. And it's unnecessary pressure on the customer, right? Which is going to strain the relationship and makes it feel like I have to buy at certain periods on your time and not on my time, or else I'm going to pay more than I should. And so how do you, as somebody who's running a sales team, how do you balance that, you know, what we really want versus what we have to get done in a certain time period?
So in terms of a sales, like as an example, we have to sell 50 units in a quarter. So ask me the question one more time.
Yeah. So if you're looking at, if we're the anti-metric sales leader, mm-hmm. right? We still have like consistency is king when it comes to planning Correct. And forecasting. So what does it look like when you set your goals for the year mm-hmm. and then, you know, maybe you're a little bit behind on a quarter, maybe you're a little bit behind on a year. What does that look like in your universe?
Yeah. So again, the idea of metrics-based selling is having a forecast that has numbers and metrics that you live or die by with your salespeople. Living in a value-based instead of a metrics-based organization doesn't mean there aren't metrics on the back end, right? Your accountants internally, they have no other way of thinking. It's how they think. They're always going to think based upon closing percentages and that sort of thing. So it's the same concept. You're just changing what you value. In the volume-based sales, metrics-based sale, you're valuing the touch, right? And the touch is handshakes, cold calls, number of people I talk to. In the value-based scenario, you're valuing what comes from those discussions. I value more the actual in-depth conversations instead of the handshakes and the cold calls that piss people off. So how does that look? It's what is it going to take? If you're my salesperson, I'm going to ask you, okay, so we know that this year we'd like to have this much revenue. What's that look like to you? How many people do you think you need to talk to and have deep conversations with this year? And we work from there. Because again, you may be able to, you may be a 24-year-old who doesn't know anybody with money. You know a bunch of worker bees. You may have to talk and have deeper conversations with more people. But that's you. That's your own personal metric based upon deep conversations. For me, I'm 44 today, by the way. Happy birthday, hey, me.
Happy birthday, dude.
Yeah. And so the value of my contacts is going to be more than the 24-year-old there. So my conversations can be deeper, and I probably don't have to have as many. Right? So this is not about a metrics, global metrics system where everybody is fit into a box. It's about working with you individually to talk about deep conversations that will lead to trust, that will lead to sales. And then in training, by the way, we can talk about how to get to those deep conversations. That's the other part that we haven't mentioned here. The training is all the same in a metrics-based sales organization. It's all based on how many phone calls do you need to make? How do I overcome these objections on the phone call? How do I do a consultative sale, but the whole time I'm just thinking about how to sell that person instead of how do I do a consultative approach where I'm actually consulting and figuring out deeply what that person needs and letting them go if I can't help, right? We don't teach that. We teach the metric. We teach the phone call. We teach the handshake. Instead of teaching people how to be human and how to give back to a community and how to create an instant trust when I walk in the door. And so what does it look like? Hell, again, any salesperson listening, it sounds like Nirvana.
Like Teen Spirit.
And I think that's the way it looks.
Yeah. And I think if I look at like, why do people fall back onto metrics and just rely on those to make decisions? I think it's just a lack of knowledge, a lack of experience, a lack of trust in your people. If you're doing proper call review with them, if you're doing proper sort of pipeline scoring and you have great insight into their pipeline, and you can say with confidence that I know this person is doing a great job. Mm-hmm. The metrics at the end of the day, whether they closed, 100%, 120%, or 80%, they don't tell the whole story. And so if you have a deep understanding of your salespeople, then the metrics are less and less valuable. And I think that's the piece that you're pushing forward, is you really need to understand sales, how to understand what's really going to drive the pipeline, and where the reps need to work on. And so that you can have that trust that when they do get those 10 really high quality ups, they are going to hit your 18.219684% average closing rate.
And as a matter of fact, their closing rate's probably going to go up, but that's mm-hmm. we won't talk about that. No, you're right. What happens, right, is think about leadership. It's hard enough to find good salespeople. It's even more difficult to find really good leaders, right? So it's most people who are managers, especially in a sales organization, are there because they were a good salesperson before, right? I mean, that's most of the time how it works. Well, it's a lot easier to throw out metrics than it is to do one-on-one training with someone to figure out what is it that you're really good at. What, from an industry standpoint, what does your personality work with best? That's a difficult training. Or at least it's difficult compared to the metrics-based training, which says, dude, how many calls did you make today? Well, you're not going to get anywhere if you don't make 50 calls.
It's so much more cut and dry, right? With the metrics, it's obvious. With the value-based, it's a lot more real hard work.
So it is.
It's the cop-out to go the metrics route almost.
I agree. I mean, you're not really training if you're training on numbers of calls and, hey, go to the phone book and find 50 people to call. That's lazy. So I completely agree.
So talk to me about the impact you've seen this have on organizations that are moving in this direction.
People are happier. People are have longer tenured salespeople. Again, the difficulty in sales organizations is the turnover, right? Mm-hmm. And then because training sucks, people don't have the right tools to go in. They come in, they get off, they go off like gangbusters, right? Because the metric-based system basically makes them think, oh crap, who do I need to call who will talk to me? And people will like to say that that's network marketing or MLM. No, it's regular sales. Call your family and friends. I'm sorry if anybody's watching this from New York Live, but that's the model. In insurance, it's the model. Look, you're going to talk to this many people, and you know what? Go talk to your family and friends. Well, when you take all of a sudden you do that, and you have no one else to call, and everybody's gone, and everybody's pissed off. By the way, they're pissed off because now their family's pissed off at them. So what happens when you do this? You have people that stay longer. You have people that are better trained. They enjoy their job more, because as a salesperson, their job is really community organizer. Their job is really, how do I go make a difference and give to the community? Because I know when I do that, I get to know people in the community that will help me. I don't have to worry now about, oh my gosh, my pipeline is dry. Well, the only reason people say their pipeline is dry is because in the metrics-based system, when you're having to make, let's say it's 10 calls a day, 10 calls a day, 20 work days a month, 200 calls a month. How the hell do you find 200 people a month who are absolutely interested in what you do? That's stressful. You know what? Instead of that, because you don't know, most of those people aren't interested. Instead of that, if you say, look, I want you to talk to and engage with 10 interested people a month, and here's how you're going to create those interested people, because you're still going to sell the same amount. Now, all of a sudden, pipeline management is easier. Pipeline management is about creating an actual prospect in the pipeline, not someone that I talked to one time, or not someone who the AI in our Salesforce says is a good potential person. So in an organization that will do this, think about that. You have salespeople who walk in happy. You have salespeople who are not stressed out and they don't yell at underwriting. They don't yell at customer service. They're not worried about customer service making a mistake because customer service is human. Because a little mistake is okay with a current client because you developed a relationship and you know about this individual. You don't have to worry about it. It really is a much more freeing kind of environment. It just takes someone with balls to do it. Someone with the guts to say, you know what, this metrics-based stuff is the reason that we have only a 75% employee or customer satisfaction. It's the only reason that we have 20% of our people leaving annually, our customers. Why do you have that? Our customer retention is low. It's because you're just throwing people in and hoping they stick. It's just not the way to do business. Not today, at least.
Totally agree. Josh, I feel like we could, a couple of sales guys on a conversation, we could just go on for hours, but I want to be respectful of your time. It's also your birthday. Happy birthday, dude.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. And I know it's probably getting close to beer, whiskey drinking time. So I want to move to the lightning round and let's get a couple real quick responses and then we'll do the cold call thing and then we'll wrap it up so you can go get your birthday beers on.
Let's do it.
All right. So how do you get people to reply to your emails?
Video email. Video email. So think about all the emails you get. The emails you get have terrible headlines. You open it up and it's a sales pitch and you say, screw this. This sucks. All of my emails, hey, I've made a quick video for you. This is Josh with First Start. So they know who I am. Mm-hmm. I don't email, by the way, people that I don't know. So that's, by the way, part of it, at least that I've met. Right. Mm-hmm. If I haven't met them, I'm not sending you a cold email. And then in the email, I have the thumbnail. I know how to create it. I use a system. I hope it's okay to say this. I use a system called Dub. Dub is fantastic. It hosts your emails there or your videos right there. You can create the, when you put that in there, the video in the email, it'll automatically embed it in. Mm-hmm. And you can even make it so that immediately when they open it, it will start. It'll start going. They don't have to push play.
Gotcha.
And it doesn't create something, download on their computer. So all the bad things about doing videos in the past through email, this takes it over. And then it has a call to action at the end, which is nice. So that's how I get people to do it. And again, it's just about, it's kind of like on LinkedIn, people talk about how do I get people to stop and look at my content? It's about getting people to stop scrolling. In email, it's just about how do you make yourself stand out with all the muck and the mess? Well, a really good title, telling them what it is you want them to do. And then in the email, having something other than a boring written post that says, hey, sorry, I just want to take a couple of minutes of your time, right? Those don't work. So my emails do.
Perfect. When you first said that, I was picturing you doing like a Doogie Howser style with like the blue screen, the white text, and you just like speaking while you type to your journal. I was thinking,
that'd be awesome.
This is my favorite sales tactic ever. I think even though that's not what you're saying, I think I want to test that out.
I'm telling you. So it's just like, I love the Matrix.
Yeah.
And if you remember, once he gets in and they're putting him through these things and the guy goes, hey, watch this. And he is in there and there's all these people walking back and forth on the street. And then he sees the girl in the red dress that's really hot. And the idea of that was it's out of the ordinary. It's different. Mm-hmm. And that you had to focus on that lady because everything else was black and white and boom, there's red. It's the same thing in marketing and sales. It's the same thing that I try to coach like realtors with. Stop sending postcards. If everybody's sending a postcard, do something different.
Yeah.
And so it's just about setting yourself up for success in that regard. So I want to see that. Send me an email with that. I'll open it.
The Doogie Howser? Hell yeah, man.
Yeah.
Cool. So how do you handle the brush off when you're getting it on a cold call?
So give me a brush off to handle.
I'm too busy. Just stepping into a meeting.
Cool. Talk to you later.
Just let it drop.
So here's what I think, right? One, a true cold call. It's the idea of changing the narrative of what it is we do. Cold calls are interesting, right? Because the idea of the cold call is to have a conversation. If you have to overcome four objections to get them to talk to you for 2 minutes, is it really a conversation? And is it really doing anything of value? So if the guy if I'm talking about strict cold calls and I'm not working in a metrics-based organization, which I don't, by the way, First Star HR, it's the best place ever because they allow us to do it this way. And that's what we're teaching everybody. Then what's the point of me spending 2 minutes to get that guy to give me another minute and a half? If he's actually going to a meeting, I'm just going to piss him off. If he's not going to a meeting, I'm telling him that he's a liar, and that's going to piss him off. Mm-hmm. So at that point, that's cool. I'll talk to you later. And if he says, nope, don't call me back, okay, good deal. If he says, okay, cool, he just gave me permission to call again, so I'm going to put him on the calendar and I'll call him back. Again, it's about changing the mindset of what it is we're expecting. I had this big, deep discussion with someone the other day, and I think they came to my conclusion eventually, but it was, how do we overcome all these other objections? And my discussion is, why do we have all these objections? Right? If you're at the end of a sales call and the guy starts throwing out objections, I did personally as a salesperson a shitty job of handling the things that I knew he would object to up front. Right? What do people object to? Don't have time. It's too expensive. Got to talk to someone else. We all know that the objections are fairly normal when it comes to sales. Mm-hmm. Well, if I don't know that he has to talk to someone else at the very end, shame on me. If I didn't tell them the price up front to allow them to have a gasp moment, oh my gosh, it's so expensive. If I leave that conversation at the very end having them gasp, I deserve to lose that sale. So I look at objections in a different way. I on a cold call, phone call, cold call, if they give me an objection, okay. Okay, bye. And I know that a lot of people watching this are going to go, no, that's wrong. You're losing out. Well, I don't do sales that way. And so if I'm going to call someone and they say no, then, and I say, well, yeah, you really do have time. I'm just pissing them off and I'm never going to sell it. If mm-hmm. I go into an actual call and have a discussion and they give me all the objections at the end, that's my fault. So I just do a better job of prospecting up front, qualifying up front, doing the research I need to do before I make a call to you, right? Mm-hmm. Then I don't get those things. So it's a little bit different probably than most, but that's how I handle it.
Love it. And so last lightning round question, what do you do when you need to push at the end of a quarter?
So push for new business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you run a little bit behind.
I get out into the community. Here's a cool thing that happens when you are community-based. Right? You're going into the community. The community will help you. They will. They will help you. People tend to disregard community, yet they need the community to actually sell. And so if I've spent the year getting to know the community, working with the community, helping in the community, talking and having deep discussions in the community, selling in the community, at the end of a quarter, if I'm a little behind, I can go to that community. Mm-hmm. Right? And they want to help me because I haven't been salesy throughout the year. I haven't asked for them. I haven't cold called people out of the blue. I haven't treated them like a number. I've created relationships. And if I do that, you know, the whole, let's say it's 10 a month. If I create, hell, that's 10 a month. Let's say I'm in November. That 10 a month, that's 100 through October. I've got 100 great discussions. And I've sold 20% of those, by the way, 18.9. There's a bunch of people there I can go to who like me, who care about me because I've developed a relationship. I can go to the community now and say, hey, who should I talk to? And I'll get the business. So again, that's what I do. I go back into the community.
I love it. I can't get the idea of trying to find a way to use to go back to our last idea. So I love that you're going back to the community. And in this case, it could be the physical community. It could be the sales community. It could be an online community. We're not just talking about going and knocking on doors and meeting people.
That's right.
It's existing and being a member of whatever community you're a part of.
And that's a good point. Community doesn't have to mean in and around your city. Mm-hmm. The community is what you make of it, right? It could be LinkedIn. LinkedIn's your community. You're giving back to it all the time. It can be that. It can be Facebook. It can be your social media. It can be your fraternity brothers from 20 years ago in college, right? Whatever that community is, that's what you're working.
Totally. So want to let you get you, we're getting one step closer to your birthday beers. Last piece. So cold call me. This is basically your opportunity to promote anything that you want. We're going to do it through a cold call role play.
Cool.
I'm not sure how I'm going to handle the objections, because I normally throw out some like ones that it sounds like you would just be like, cool, hang up on.
So we'll
maybe I'll ask, you know, just try and steamroll me. Because otherwise doing this 10 takes till you find the right perfect time might not work great for a podcast.
Let's do it.
So what's the, paint a word picture for me. Who am I? Who are you calling in? Why are you calling?
Okay. So hold on real quick. Am I cold calling you or are you cold calling me?
You're calling me.
All right.
And this is your chance to promote whatever you want. Could be first star HR, could be coming
to. I'll make it better. This will be more challenging for me. Who are you? You tell me who you are. What you can make up any industry you want.
Okay. Let's say I am a director of customer success at a SaaS company.
Okay, cool. Well, hey, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. I really appreciate you spending 3 seconds on the phone. I'm going to ask for 15 more seconds, okay? I am the director of channel partnerships for First Star HR. I help you save 30% over 36 months. We will help you grow 25% in revenue over the next 24. Would you allow me to show you how to make that happen?
Yeah.
Cool.
Done.
I'll get you on the books. So, you know, what's interesting, right, is, and I'm taking out a cord here because it just totally smacked me in the butt. The cool thing about cold calling, if you do it right, is it's all about quick value. Someone once told me in any meeting, be bold, be brief, right? Be bright. Bold, brief, bright. Bold, brief, bright. So if that's the case, I tell you that you can save this and I'm going to grow you. And can I get you on, can I set up a time to do it? You're not going to say no, especially if I do it quickly.
That's fair.
And if you do say no, and I said, hey, who doesn't want to save that? Then there's no way you're ever going to say yes. And I say, thank you for your time.
That's fair. Josh, this was awesome. I love the, this is like the Kobayashi Maru. You beat the system without me. You didn't let me throw any objections. I love it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. If people are saying, hey, this guy sounds like a cool cat to work for, or they've got questions, they want advice on how to build a sales org like this, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Man, you know what? Hit me up on LinkedIn. Joshua cool. W. Deshay. If you're not connected with me, I think it'll just say Joshua WD. Look me up on LinkedIn. You can also go to my website, which is joshuadeshay.com. Deshay is D-E-S-H-A. And hit me up.
Sounds great. Josh, thanks so much. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Man, it was good to talk to you.
Great talking to you too. See everybody else next week.